Welcome back to the Legally Abled podcast. My name is Ashley Jacobson, and I am a certified rehabilitation counselor, and I have my master's degree in rehabilitation counseling from Michigan State University, and have spent my whole career devoted to working with people with disabilities. Today, I am very, very excited to discuss a topic that is near and dear to my heart. This week, I was really honored to present a training to the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office in Lansing, Michigan, on how to assist and assess a situation where a victim has a disability. So this is a problem that I saw pretty frequently in my counseling practice when I worked with a nonprofit as a counselor, and I saw that people with disabilities could be susceptible to certain crimes, and they dealt with unique issues with regards to being able to report those crimes and in people understanding how their disability affects how they describe the crime and how their disability may affect changes that need to be made to make the legal system and our process more accessible. So I was very excited that I was able to provide that training in Lansing. And it was really important to me that I provide a good background on where we're at with disability and crime in the United States. And I thought I would create a podcast episode talking about current cases from the past year where the person with a disability is a victim of a crime and the unique issues that it presents when wanting to help that person. So I want to preface all of this by saying that people with disabilities should not be seen as weak or vulnerable or helpless individuals. They can be successful and capable and strong and intelligent people. But there are, unfortunately, in this country, many, many people with disabilities that become victims of crime. And there are certain populations of people with certain disabilities that experience crime victimization at an even higher rate. So where we're at currently, in 2017, I'm going to talk about a few cases that are extremely shocking, and I want to point out certain observations that I have from those cases. So in Chicago in 2017, a really highly publicized case involved an 18-year-old victim who has mental disabilities in Chicago. And there were four suspects aged 18 to 24 who bound this individual, covered his mouth with tape, beat him repeatedly, and forced this 18-year-old man to drink toilet water and posted it in a live video on Facebook. Like I said, they bound his wrists, taped his mouth shut, and they also used a knife to cut his clothes. And the next details, they are pretty disturbing, but they, in his open wounds, tapped their cigarette ashes into his open wounds. Throughout this torture, they yelled racist comments and towards the individual, but also towards the President of the United States, Donald Trump. And this was a situation that the media correctly reported as a hate crime. These individuals were charged with a hate crime in Chicago, but something that was overlooked completely and mentioned very little in the media was how this 18-year-old was a victim with a disability. And from viewing the disturbing images and video from this case, what makes it all the more devastating, obviously nobody with or without a disability, should ever have to deal with this type of torture. But to me, what made it all the more devastating was that this was a person who was targeted based on being a vulnerable individual. The fact that these four suspects saw this person as somebody they could gang up on, because in speaking with him, they could tell he had a significant mental disability. It shows not only that he was victimized and that it was a hate crime based on the racial comments that were made, but also that it could be a hate crime based on the fact that he had a disability, and they perceived him as being weak, not worthy of respect, and an easy target. To me, the other shocking element of this case, and is something that you'll see in other cases that I talk about, is that the suspects are fairly young. So the perpetrators of many crimes against people with disabilities tend, recently at least, to be younger individuals, teenagers, young adults. And I think it poses a really interesting question about why these criminals are choosing a person with a disability as one of their first targets for criminal behavior. And to me, it's terrifying because, one, obviously it's something that no person with a disability or without a disability should ever have to experience as a victim. But two, it's showing that people are first exhibiting horrendous criminal behavior from a young age, and experimenting with criminal behavior and violent behavior with the disability population. And that is something that really needs to be addressed and talked about that really hasn't been. So that was in Chicago. In Texas, 2017, there was a police report and a case that was ongoing where there were three teenage boys who allegedly raped a girl with mental disabilities in their high school restroom. The students accused of the rape were 17, 17, and 19 years old. And they took turns standing outside of the high school restroom as lookouts while the others raped and sexually assaulted this young 16-year-old victim. This brave victim did report the assault 4 days later. But the fact that a student with a disability was victimized in her own high school and can't feel safe in one of the only places that people with disabilities should feel 100% safe, comfortable. It's a learning environment. They're supposed to go there to feel comfortable enough to learn and grow and become independent. And now this girl has been victimized in an environment that was supposed to protect her, and victimized by peers her own age, or around her own age. And it's just devastating. And I am incredibly proud of this victim for reporting the crime. And I really hope and pray that she is able to move forward with her life and not let these terrible criminals, you know, affect her long term. So that was in Texas. In Pennsylvania, in 2017, there was a man with cerebral palsy that was at a gas station. He went there, he walked into the gas station to buy some things. He walked out, and as he was walking out, he was mocked by a fellow gas station customer and punched without any provocation by the other customer. And this link and the other links to the articles and cases that I'm mentioning today will be posted on legallyable.com so that you can read more about these cases as they develop. But again, this is a situation where the attacker was not a young adult or a teen, but it was a grown adult man who had no reason whatsoever to first mock this individual with cerebral palsy, but did so based on his observations that the person did have some type of disability. But he certainly had no reason to physically punch this man who is just trying to go about his day-to-day life as adults do. And it's another instance where a person with a disability is in an environment that most people feel safe in. You go to the gas station for gas, you typically don't feel like you're going to be attacked or that you could be attacked. And the unfortunate truth is that many people with disabilities have to have their guard up in public situations based on stigma that is thrown at them, based on mocking that is thrown at them, and as seen in this case, based on being in physical danger as well. Another really interesting and shocking and saddening case out of Pennsylvania in 2017, there were four young people ranging in age from 12 years old to 15 years old. These are children and teens. And from that age, they thought it was appropriate to take a video that went viral on the internet, of these teens punching and assaulting a 38-year-old man with a disability at an intersection in the middle of the street where people were walking back and forth completely unprovoked. So the article, which comes out of Philadelphia, discusses more about the video, but this is a shocking, shocking crime. Because it's showing that from a very young age, teenagers are realizing that they can get attention by fighting and posting it on the internet. And there are many, many websites and apps for which I will not advertise on my podcast by saying them, but they are easy to find if you know, just search online for articles about how atrocious these sites are. But there are many, many apps and sites that encourage young adults to engage in really violent behavior. And people, thousands and thousands of people, like the videos online. They comment on the videos online. And it creates this sense of ego in the people that are fighting that this is how you get acceptance. This is how you feel cool. You feel like you're, you know, a badass, but it's something that we really as a culture need to address and that we haven't done a great job of addressing. Granted, it is a fairly new, invention, having the internet and websites and apps devoted to this kind of violent behavior, but it's something that is taking off very, very quickly, and it's very disturbing. So in this case, a 12-year-old up to 15-year-olds decided that they wanted to attack a 38-year-old man with to many, it was apparent that he had a disability based on watching him conduct himself publicly and in his employment. And these four young people attacked him pretty brutally. And again, it just is devastating to the community. It's devastating because this 38-year-old man was employed. He was going about his day-to-day life, being successful and working hard and not bothering or creating a problem with anybody, yet he was attacked in a situation where nobody should feel like they are going to be attacked walking down the street in a busy intersection. In Idaho, in 2015, going back a couple of years, I bring this up because even though it was from 2015, it's a case that ignited a fire within me, because there has been largely a lack of accountability on the perpetrators of the crime. So in Idaho in 2015, dealing with high school students, again, young people who are finding that it's acceptable to target a person with a disability to experiment with their criminal behavior, there was a boy who was in the locker room after a football practice, and the football teammates were in there with him, and when one teammate held his arms out to this young man after the practice, the young man with a disability, who it was well known he had the disability, he had exhibited his disability in school pretty obviously. The teammates were very aware that he had disabilities, and they went out, they approached him like they were giving him a hug. And so this young man with a disability thought he was going to get a hug, so he reciprocated and had his arms out, and the teammate restrained this young man with a disability while another high school football player thrust a coat hanger into the victim's rectum, and a third football player kicked the coat hanger several times while it was inside of the victim. This case is horrifying, and it's important to note that, in my opinion, it's important to note that the victim was an African-American young man with quite well-known and significant disabilities, and the perpetrators against him were white, and they were boys that felt entitled to assaulting and victimizing this young man who was in school, in a locker room, participating in a school event and program, who should feel safe and who should feel like he is not in danger by being in school, but by participating in sports, for which people with disabilities have for many, many years been isolated from the sports community in schools, and they are finally gaining ground in having people with disabilities participate in school sports and other clubs and events. And now this happens where, you know, young teenage men, boys, thought it's appropriate, thought it was funny, and thought it was acceptable to sexually assault a young man with a coat hanger in such a violent, violent way. It's terrifying to me because they are teenagers and this is a school setting, and if they believe that this behavior is appropriate and they targeted this young man because they thought he was vulnerable because of his disabilities, then we need to be doing better in educating our youth about people with disabilities and about the respect that they deserve. The other thing that is important when discussing victims with disabilities is the fact that there are many instances where these crimes could have been avoided with the appropriate supervision, especially when the person with a disability is a child or a teenager, or is especially participating in a school event. So we need to be taking steps to ensure that people with disabilities can feel safe in these places where most people do feel safe. But also, we need to be making sure that there are methods and strategies that allow a person with a disability to report when a crime has happened, and make them feel comfortable coming forward and like they have an ally in our legal system and in our day-to-day lives. In Indiana, in 2017, so getting back to 2017, there was an 18-year-old girl who cognitively was at the age of 5, but was 18 years old in age, was sexually assaulted by a 33-year-old man. In Minnesota in 2017, there was a victim who was a young man with a physical disability who was attacked outside of a Target store by suspects that are familiar to him. And I will just say that in most instances where crimes are committed against people with disabilities, they are committed by somebody that they know personally or who is their caretaker. So this incident in Minnesota outside of the Target store was committed by suspects familiar to him, but it only garnered police attention after the video of the incident was posted to Facebook, which provides really interesting feedback on how our police investigations are changing. In some respects, it's concerning that people, instead of going to the police with crimes, are posting it to Facebook. But it's also a little bit of a relief that police are paying attention to what's being posted online and social media. So in Michigan, where I'm from, initially, I'm from Philadelphia, but now I am in Michigan and have been for a very long time. In Michigan in 2017, there was a case of a 29-year-old woman with mental and physical disabilities who met a couple and said, "I'm looking for a place to live." That couple invited this woman to live with them, but when she didn't have money to pay rent, they forced her to live in a shed outdoors. She was not allowed access to a restroom or a shower, and she was prostituted by the couple in order to allow her to live in this shed. And the woman was initially told she could live with them, but that's kind of how she was led into their scheme. And from there, they basically approached her as a way of them making money. And it's a common problem that people with disabilities face in this country, is being victims of crime by people who commit the crime for financial motives. So things occur very frequently. There was another case in Michigan in 2017 where a person with a disability was their parent was using them, saying that they were the owner of the home in order to hide that, you know, their parent actually owned the home. And there's many instances of Social Security disability where caretakers of people with disabilities are taking the Social Security disability money that should be going towards the person with a disability. There are also several financial scams that target people with disabilities. And I will get into that a little bit more because I have had personal experience with a client who dealt with that, and it was a huge loss. But in this case specifically, with this 29-year-old woman who had quite significant mental and physical disabilities, being forced to live in a shed in conditions that, you know, I would never even suspect an animal to. The fact that this couple in Macomb Township thought it was appropriate to, one, force this woman to live in that environment, but two, to prostitute her against her will for money, for which she received none and they received all, is indicative of our society's attitudes towards people with disabilities. People with disabilities in our society and historically have been deemed unworthy of respect, unworthy of understanding, unworthy of equal protection under the law. And attitudes towards people with disabilities, while they have improved over the years, there's still such a long way to go. It should never, ever be okay to treat any human being in these ways that these people have been treated in the cases I've mentioned. But it is especially astounding that people would target a person with a disability in ways of which nobody would normally feel in danger in those situations. And that's what is important that we discuss, not only with police and with attorneys that help people with disabilities who've been victims of crime, but we also have a conversation about that with people with disabilities. There needs to be significant training on how a person with a disability can protect themselves in day-to-day life and in our legal system. And there's so much more that could be done in this area, and I'm really excited to explore that further in future episodes of this podcast. Also in Michigan in 2017, Battle Creek, Michigan, there was a 4-year-old victim who is suspected of sustaining a brain injury from child abuse and severe neglect, who also has evidence of a developmental disability. This 4-year-old sustained several injuries, head injuries and other. He had open sores on his body. He had evidence of being severely malnourished and neglected. And this also presents something that you do hear about from time to time, where parents with disabilities are abusing their child who has a disability. And it's it's challenging because there are so many wonderful, wonderful parents who are advocates, who love their child, who want their child with a disability to be successful and fulfilled and experience all the joys of life. But unfortunately, for many reasons, some of which are more profoundly exhibited in lower socioeconomic situations and areas of poverty, but also in areas where people tend to lack levels of appropriate education, you see that there are many incidents of parents who are abusing their child who has a disability. And it could come from a wide variety of things. There are parents who do this who don't want to have a child with a disability. They see it as extra work. They see a child as it and not a real child. And they don't value their child with a disability. They don't want to spend the extra effort working with that child. to which, if you don't want to care for a child with a disability, in my mind, you just shouldn't have children. Because, like I said before, disability is part of the human experience. Everybody at some time in their life will have a disability. And as many parents who have been successful and wonderful parents of children with disabilities will tell you, it is no different. There's no different love that a parent has towards one child with a disability and one without. The love is the same. Their desires for them to be successful are the same. And it can be done, even though there are really a lot of ups and downs. So it's disturbing that some parents of children that have disabilities, don't see the alternatives or don't care to find out how they could appropriately parent a child with a disability. So those are just some common cases that have occurred in the past year and couple of years dealing with individuals with disabilities. Like I said, I will be posting the links to those articles about those cases on legallyable.com. But what is obvious throughout looking at all of these cases is that we have a real problem here. And this is a problem that cannot be ignored. And it's been ignored historically. And what we found from that being ignored is that it's incredibly dangerous to not address this problem head on. And so in meeting with different prosecutors' offices and schools and workplaces and with parents' organizations and other agencies, I have really found that there are many things that we can do to better understand victims with disabilities and to provide assistance throughout the legal process. Because like any other victim of a crime, a person with a disability deserves justice. They deserve to see the person who committed the crime against them pay for that crime. And there are unique issues that have come into play with victims with disabilities. One big issue is that investigators and attorneys haven't historically been trained in disability issues. And it's really important that they are. And I'm happy to provide those trainings. So feel free to reach out to me at legallyabled@gmail.com if you are interested in that. But another big issue is that people with disabilities have a really low rate of reporting crime. And, you know, some of the issues with that come from, you know, their perpetrator, their abuser, is always with them. And like I said before, maybe the person has a limited vocabulary. Maybe they use a communication device, or they have a communication difference that the investigators aren't aware of. Maybe they are being influenced by people that are they think are helping them, but really they're guiding them away from receiving the justice from the crimes for which they were victimized. But also another huge challenge is that our courts have generally had an attitude towards witnesses with disabilities as seeing them as being unreliable. And the reason of this is that they have found, the courts, attorneys, prosecutors, investigators have found that it's a little bit more challenging to get the appropriate information from the person with a disability, which is disappointing, because there are many reasonable accommodations that could be used to assist in getting the full story and the full experience from that person with a disability. That if you just took a couple extra minutes to prepare and you used a different technique and method for interviewing that person, then you could get all of the information you need and pursue justice against the criminal. But because of the lack of training, you know, our system typically has not pursued many cases where the victim has a disability, because it's more difficult to gather that evidence. But also, you know, our court system is improving in its accessibility, but it's also a very intimidating environment for somebody with a disability. It can be intimidating for people without disabilities also, for sure. And so it can be challenging to make the person with a disability feel comfortable in testifying. And there are many techniques that can be used to help them feel more comfortable, things like allowing the person to bring an item of comfort. Many people with disabilities, especially sensory processing disorders, traumatic brain injuries, mental illness, anxiety disorders, people who are on the autism spectrum, things like weighted blankets, weighted coats, things they call, but they're actually kind of common nowadays for even people without disabilities, but things like fidget spinners and other types of fidget items that you can keep in your hand when possible, allowing the person to stand or pace while talking in an interview. That can help, you know, get more information out of them. And allowing these coping techniques can really improve a prosecutor's office or a detective's, agency in getting the information they need from the person with a disability. And there are several coping techniques that they can even introduce to make the person feel more comfortable. The other issue is that, you know, our court system, we have many wonderful judges, highly educated judges, that have done a wonderful job in seeking justice and providing appropriate sentencing for the criminals that come through the system. However, I do believe that it is necessary for judges to receive more information on disability-specific issues. And it's up to, you know, the attorneys that come before the judge. It is up to the advocates that assist people with disabilities. It's up to people like myself to providing those trainings to judges and attorneys, and up to the community for really advocating for an accessible system so that people with disabilities are able to seek justice and they have judges who understand and are accommodating for their disability. Another interesting topic with regards to crime and disability is that many crimes against people with disabilities can be sexual in nature. And it's very taboo to talk about sex in our culture. However, it is becoming more mainstream to talk about it. But sex and disability are two words that many people do not feel comfortable using together. And what I always say about that is children with disabilities grow up to be teenagers with disabilities who grow up to be adults with disabilities. And like any other adult, people with disabilities have, you know, sexual desires and relationships. And unfortunately, in our society, many of them reach adulthood without receiving proper sexual education. And so in my training and experience, I've worked in a school setting, I've worked in a nonprofit setting, and I've heard from people with disabilities and people who work with people with disabilities about some of the unique instances where disability has affected how individuals have understood sexual education. So there was one instance of a young couple with Down syndrome. Both individuals had Down syndrome, and they were adults, young adults, and they were getting married. And prior to getting married, they were trained, they had a little sex ed course, and in that sex ed course, they were shown to put a condom on a banana. And they said, this is how you put the condom on. They showed them with the banana, and then the teacher moved on. So then these individuals, they get married, they decide they want to have sex, and consensually they do so, and they return the next day, and they find they're telling their friends and everybody, oh yeah, it was great, you know, of course their friends are like, how was it? And they're like, yeah, well, we made sure to put that condom on the banana, and we put it on the nightstand next to the bed, so we were definitely safe when we were having sex. And it's a classic story, but it's one that's a really good indication of how we need to tailor our sexual education to the disability community and to individuals in that community. So disability can provide differences in cognitive processing. It could provide differences in how they perceive the information that you're saying to them. And some individuals may take things very literally, as was the case with the condom and the banana. Unfortunately, it is also the case that when individuals with disabilities are not educated on appropriate sexual behavior, they are also not educated on inappropriate sexual behavior, which leads to a lack of reporting sexual crimes that are against people with disabilities. So it's really vital that we have conversations with people with disabilities about sexuality and what is healthy and appropriate and realistic for adults with disabilities, and recognizing that adults with disabilities want to have sex and want to be in healthy relationships and marriages, and many want to have children of their own and are fully capable of being wonderful parents. And also recognizing that we need to train individuals with disabilities to know when they are being inappropriately touched and victimized and how to report it. Because listen, when somebody is a victim of a crime, especially a crime that is sexual in nature, it can be extremely difficult for that person to discuss that crime with a parent when they need to ask for help. Because one, a victim of a sexual crime can see themselves as feeling very ashamed, even feeling guilty, like it must have been my fault, I put myself in a certain situation, or, you know, maybe they're supposed to do that to me, I'm not really sure, like especially people with disabilities, if it's dealing with somebody who's a caretaker, maybe they were taught that's how love is shown. But regardless, it's difficult to talk about sex with your parents, right? I mean, many people are going to agree with me on that. It's especially difficult to tell your parents that you've been a victim of a sexual crime. It's difficult on top of that when you may not have the words or training to describe what has happened to you. So we need to be training people with disabilities from an appropriate age about sex ed, about appropriateness and inappropriateness, and about who they can come to report or to just ask questions about what's normal and what isn't. And we need to make sure that there are those avenues available to that person with a disability so that it's not 1 in 5 people that report the crime. It's 5 in 5, and those 5 victims are able to obtain justice in our system. So because there are many different strategies for communicating with people with disabilities, and it should be individualized to the person with a disability, it is really important that if you have a question that's specific to a certain person with a disability or a disability type or a certain type of crime committed against a person with a disability, that you keep in mind that how you tailor that discussion should be very tailored to that person's needs and communication style. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions if you want to reach out to me over email. Again, it's legallyabled@gmail.com. And I will do my best to provide the right resources and to answer your questions. But some overarching tips for communicating with a victim with a disability. If you are an attorney, you're in the prosecutor's office, or you're pursuing a civil suit representing a person with a disability, or you are a loved one of a person with a disability who is a victim of a crime. Some great communication tips that you can use in really figuring out what has happened and talking with this person that you care about and that you're representing to get the full story. You want to remember, again, to use person-first language. They are a person with a disability. Use their name. You know, really focus on showing them respect. You want to create an environment that's non-judgmental and that is accessible, allowing them to use their coping strategies. And you want to look for signs that the person is feeling overwhelmed and know what those signs are so that you can take a break. So some common signs of somebody feeling overwhelmed are things such as spacing out. So many people, when you see somebody kind of looking up and not really looking at anything in particular but spacing out, they appear to not be listening. But for people with disabilities, that's often a sign that they are over-processing or they have a slower cognitive processing state. So they are trying to process what you're saying, but maybe it's too much information too quickly or too many questions at once. So spacing out doesn't always mean you're being ignored, and that's really important. It could be a sign that they just need a little bit of a break. Things like rocking back and forth with their body, tics. So if somebody has a tic where they blink frequently or a certain way, or they move their head a certain way, or other types of tics that they do repeatedly, seeing those happen more and more can be a sign that the person is feeling overwhelmed. Things like stimming, like I mentioned before, incidents where the person's repeating a phrase over and over again or a song over and over again. Be aware that those repetitive statements could or could not be truthful or personal statements about the crime that was committed against them. It could be something that they overheard somebody say earlier that day, or something they saw on TV, or it could be something that, you know, they experienced when they were victims of the crime. So it's important that you really take a moment to analyze, is the thing that the person is saying repeatedly, is it something they're saying as a coping strategy, or are they trying to communicate with me what happened? So take your time and provide a break if you kind of meet a roadblock in that area. Also, if you meet a roadblock in that area, providing alternative ways for them to communicate with you, things like drawing and writing and typing. There are certain people with disabilities that have fine motor and gross motor difficulties. Things like moving your hands and being able to write can be challenging, or drawing. But when you provide larger writing tools, larger markers, larger pencils and, you know, crayons, those things can create a more accessible way for them to communicate with you, because those are easier for them to hold. And, you know, even using pictures, maps, action figures, things of that nature. And always, 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 if the person uses sign language, provide an ASL interpreter. It is shocking to me, and I'm going to be interviewing one of my colleagues who has done an immense amount of work with the deaf community and is a disability specialist in his own right. And I am excited to interview him about ways that we can improve services for people who are deaf. But I am shocked at the amount of times workplaces and government agencies and things of that nature don't provide an ASL interpreter because they're trying to save cost. You are creating so much more cost for yourself because you're delaying the process of getting the information you need. So it's actually much more efficient and cost efficient to use an ASL interpreter. Perhaps a person with a disability comes from a family where they speak a different language primarily at home, and that person may feel more comfortable speaking in that language, so also using a translator. But overall, when you're trying to help somebody with a disability, somebody who's been a victim of a crime, you want to create an environment that best enables them to relay to you what's going on, and you want to be receptive to that. You don't want to be annoyed that you are taking different steps to get the result that you need. Because it is a problem that we cannot afford to ignore any longer. People with disabilities in this country are being susceptible to violent crime, to financial crime, to things like forced labor. And I have worked with individuals with disabilities in my counseling caseload who have called the police for help because they were being held at knife point and could not explain that situation to the police. I've had people with disabilities who, during tax season especially, so right around this time of year, are vulnerable to scams, financial scams. I had a client who lost, you know, nearly $7,000 because certain scams target places that they know employ people with disabilities and nonprofits that they know provide a paycheck to a person with a disability, and they call that person with a disability and impersonate the government, and they typically even have a Washington, D.C. Connected phone number that shows up on the person with a disability's phone as from Washington, D.C., and then they say they're calling from the government and the IRS, and they just need to verify some of their tax information that they sent in, and you know, the person with a disability has now lost a significant amount of money that they cannot get back. And so it's really important that people with disabilities are also trained on what to look out for with regards to financial scams. But there is a major problem with people with intellectual disabilities being sexually assaulted in this country. NPR recently did a really in-depth investigation on this issue, and they provide a perspective of a woman with a disability, an intellectual disability, who is a survivor of a sexual crime. And I'm going to provide the link for that on my blog as well, because it's a really important story that people hear. And I just am so grateful for anybody that has listened. I promise next week I'm going to have a really awesome guest that I'm going to bounce some topics and current events off of, so stay tuned for that. But like I said, I just wanted to talk today about an overview of victims with disabilities. When I provide trainings to prosecutors' offices and other attorneys and schools and people with disabilities and families that have a person with a disability, when I provide those trainings, I go a lot more in-depth on different communication tips and different resources that they can utilize and accommodations that are appropriate and all of that. And so if you have any interest in that, again, feel free to reach out to me. I'd be happy to do what I can. But until next week, I am Ashley Jacobson, and this is the Legally Abled Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Legally Abled, and you can also find us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page where you can search on Facebook, Legally Abled, and our website is legallyabled.com, And I'm creating this really cool platform for people with disabilities throughout those social networking sites and throughout my blog to connect and to empower each other to be active participants in the legal system. So feel free to reach out to me via social media as well. Legally Abled is spelled LegallyAbled.com. Thank you.